So one follow-up question about that story. Did your committee know that you had a learning disability? Like, was that something that they knew about?
That's a really good question. My first committee, I didn't want to tell them, because even though I was in a disability, I got accommodations in my classes, I didn't want to tell my first committee. And what I did after I failed it, a new committee is formed, and the one person on the committee stays on. And that was the person that I was talking to before about it, and his name is Dr. Now. And one thing that the director of the Disability Resource Office suggested was, she's like, look, if you need to take more time to answer questions, she's like, just tell your committee. Like, let them know. And she's like, it'll be fine. They won't care. And they'll understand why you're, like, taking a breath or jotting a few things down. And so I am 90% sure that I met with each of the professors before it. And I was like, look, like, I am going to take a little more time. And I'm going to have a pen and paper. And I'm going to jot down a few notes, probably before I answer it. And, you know, it's because, you know, I have the processing issue, and this is just going to help me. And they were, of course, totally fine with it. I guess it's not of course, but they were fine with it, or they appeared to be fine with it.
So you got through this, you know, particularly challenging time in your graduate career. And after that, were there any sort of notable bumps in finishing your thesis, or did it pretty much...
No, I mean, I don't think any PhD thesis is smooth sailing. I mean, some people might be. There were a lot of bumps. It's when you're in a PhD program, it's your productivity cycles, and also your attitude towards research can cycle. And there's like an exhaustion period after your comprehensive exam where, like, I immediately wanted to get back into lab and start doing work, but then, you know, I had a few months of just not being productive. But, like, I didn't want to take, like, a week break or something, you know. And so, like, that was definitely not good. There were other times that just, like, since, you know, my writing, you know, is fairly slow. And at that time, you know, it was way slower, especially when I was first learning, and that definitely caused, you know, not problems, but there were definite issues there. You know, I was in lab a lot, and I didn't, at first I was under the impression that we needed to spend all our time in lab, just because. And there were a lot of times where I would just go into lab, and even on like a winter break, and just go in there, and I would be like, okay, I have to be here. And I'd be like watching Hulu or Netflix or something. Maybe this is before Hulu, maybe like Netflix. I'd be like, all right, well, I need to be here. And like, that's something that it took me a long time to learn, that, you know, when I'm done with my work, like, I want to leave now. But when I was a graduate student, I was like, oh, well, I always have to be here. But if you decide that, oh, you're going to be at work and only do work, then you're way more productive than extending it out for like 10, 12 hours when you could get the same amount of work done in like 8 or 10 hours or whatever. And so I think like all that stuff was just like learning how to manage, you know, like my time. Another thing though that was really hard was, I think, like as I was saying like earlier, I've always been like pretty rambunctious, and I'm easily excitable, and like I just really like things a lot. And so I had to figure out even how to deal with like working in a lab with other people. And so like when I first joined my lab, it was a very intense place. And this is even before my comprehensive exam. And there were some people that I didn't get along with, and that it was hard figuring out the right balance, because this like new kid comes in and is like, oh, science is cool, blah blah blah, and is like really wild and is like, oh, this is awesome, you know, like that type of stuff, which can definitely rub people the wrong way, you know. And I definitely don't, I can't take all the, or it's definitely, it was definitely not just other people's issue. Like, it was definitely me. Like, I had to be like, oh, you know, like, I can't just, like, lay down on the middle of the floor. You know, like, I'm not a small child anymore. You know, like, that type of stuff. But there was definitely, like, that was really hard. And there was a one graduate student, and I just, like, did not get along at that time. And, like, we would yell at each other. It was just not, it was not good. But I have to say, one thing that's really awesome, though, is that over the years, and even, like, towards the end of my career as a scientist and stuff, like, we're friends now. And it's really funny that, like, in 2007, 2008, I would have been like, I will never be friends with her. But it was just, like, you know, sometimes people just rub each other the wrong way, and then whatever someone does, whether it's innocent or not, then you get annoyed by it and stuff. And so it was just, it was like a huge like learning experience. And I was like, all right, well, I can't, I'm not doing research in a vacuum. I need to make sure that, you know, I'm respectful to other people. And like, I have to make sure that people are respectful to me. And so it was, there was definitely a balance that had to happen. And it's just, I think it's just really, it's really funny now. And like, we joke about it and being like, yeah, I remember that time when we really didn't like each other. And so I think a lot of that probably happens just in normal everyday work. But I think as a graduate student, you're a little more stressed. You work a lot of hours. You're working way more than 40 hours a week. And it can be a really intense environment. And that also, that experience also like showed me that I want to I want to be a lot more laid back in my research as well.
So when did you finish up your PhD?
In 2012.
And then what did you plan to do after that? Did you already have plans
in
place when you finished?
So before I finished, I did some interviews, and I... because my research project in graduate school was helping develop an HIV-TB co-infection model, and looking at like the immunology of tuberculosis and HIV. We were working with a monkey model at the time, and the next logical step for me was moving on to human samples, or to humans. And by samples, I mean like tissue samples that are excised from people. And so before I graduated, I lined up a postdoc at the University of Cape Town with Robert Wilkinson. And so that was, I think I agreed initially to a 2-year contract, and then I ended up being there for about 3 years.
And this kind of brings to mind too, I mean, you had talked about when you were going through comps and the resulting review article that you wrote, what was that sort of, I mean, what were the sort of main questions that you had about this literature on HIV and tuberculosis?
That's great.
I mean, can you tell me more about like, the scientific inquiry you were involved in?
So just like some basics about tuberculosis is that, so tuberculosis is a bacteria, and most people inhale it, and so it's aerosolized, so when people cough and stuff. And something really interesting about tuberculosis is that the bacteria can like sit in your lungs or go to your lymph nodes, and it sits in your lungs, and your body essentially forms something called a granuloma, where these white blood cells, there's a bunch of different types of them, essentially surround this bacteria in this sphere of immune cells. And what that does is the granuloma's main function essentially is to kill the bacteria and prevent it from disseminating elsewhere in your body, okay? And so most people that get infected with tuberculosis, the bacteria, their immune responses, it works really well. Their bodies essentially form these nice granulomas, and they never get sick. And so literally it's about 10% of the people that get infected end up getting really sick, the bug or the bacteria itself like can start, it disseminates a lot. You form a lot of granulomas. The granulomas, just because a granuloma forms doesn't necessarily mean your body is killing the bacteria or killing it enough to prevent you from getting sick. And so when people are infected with HIV, HIV kills certain white blood cells. And a lot of those white blood cells are in that granuloma. And so one hypothesis that was made, and it's a very good hypothesis, is that, HIV kills these white blood cells, these CD4 T cells. And CD4 T cells are really important to granuloma function. We know if we wipe them out, and you can remove CD4 T cells in monkeys and mice and all the animals through different methods, you know, animals get really, really sick. And so what people were saying was, the reason people are getting sick is because there's killing of these white blood cells, like in the granuloma, and then it's causing the bacteria to grow. And so that was like the first inkling. And I was like, oh yeah, that sounds really smart, and that's probably correct. As people progress to AIDS and their white blood cells decrease in HIV, they become more susceptible to tuberculosis. But so I started to like dig and say, okay, well, who actually showed this in the literature? Who showed that there is this reduction of white blood cells within granulomas? And there were just a few papers. And I was like, oh, well, we're making this assumption based on evidence about what's happening in your blood, what's happening in, like, there are experiments where you can put saline in people or in people's lungs and pull them out, and then there's a bunch of white blood cells in them. And there's these reduction of these white blood cells in those areas as well. And so basically a lot of researchers were extrapolating from that peripheral evidence, the blood and the saline in your lungs, to what's happening in the granulomas. And from my research and a lot of the research that was happening in the Flynn lab and where I got my PhD, basically showed that there's very little correlation to what happens in your blood, to what happens in the saline in your lungs, to what happens in the granulomas. And so then I was like, oh, well, this is all based on peripheral evidence. And so the review essentially is broken down into a few different subtopics, and it was like, okay, so we say this is happening in the granulomas, but we're not, honestly, we don't know. Like, I think this is correct, but it's based on this evidence. There are also hypotheses about immunologically what the cells are producing, and I had the same comments. Oh, well, you know, this is what's happening peripherally. Only a few studies have shown contradictory things in the literature that's happening within the granuloma, and I think that basically the literature is as scientists are extrapolating what's happening, and so it basically went through a lot of those things, and something that actually is what I think is really cool is because this is like really my passion area is what's happening in these granulomas. I did as a postdoc, I wrote with a clinician that I was working with. We wrote a systematic review and meta-analysis of the human literature that basically focused on the human studies that actually looked at granulomas in co-infected and singly infected people. And essentially what we showed through this systematic review and meta-analysis was that the literature is very contradictory, and it's really easy to bias your interpretations by just citing a few papers that support your point, and you can support it either way. And so that was something that I really liked. I really, really liked doing, but it was a really hard paper to write because it was a systematic review and meta-analysis. And so we had these specific search terms that we had to like go through, and everything had to be documented what we were doing. And it took a really long time to write. But I really liked it. I felt like it was a nice addition to the first article that I wrote like 4 years before that.
So in your laboratory research, are you pursuing any one of those questions, or you're pursuing several of them?
Yeah.
What are you sort of seeking to to add to that sort of layer of human knowledge about this.
And so in my first postdoc at the University of Cape Town, I wanted to know, like, I wanted to do a study looking at granulomas and saying and demonstrating or identifying some correlations of HIV disease and the phenotypic appearance of granulomas, because a lot of the samples I was using, were they're from lymph nodes, and they were removed from people for diagnostic purposes, and so everything was saved in a hospital. And so then I just went to the hospital and was able to get those samples, and it took about a year to actually get them, so it was hard. But with that work, I essentially was able to get a paper out that looked at different granulomas from people, and I tried to automate the way that I was analyzing things, just to kind of reduce my bias because of this meta-analysis I was working on. I was like, oh wow, there's so much bias in this literature, and there's not enough information for people to repeat these certain studies. And so I was like, I need to make sure that everything is as straightforward as possible. And so then that was something that I was able to do. And I got a paper out focusing on how these granulomas appear different over different as HIV progresses in co-infected people. So as their white blood cells reduce, is there a correlation of a reduction in white blood cells within granulomas themselves? And I was able to show that. Is there a change in some cytokine, or some cytokines are basically molecules that are produced to like increase inflammation or decrease inflammation that white blood cells produce. And so then I was able to show certain phenotypic changes, and that's just like the appearance of them and how they look different and stuff. And so that was something else that I was real proud of, because it was, you know, my first paper that I wrote where it was just based on like my idea and my PI in Cape Town was able to gave me a lot of leeway in the experiments that I wanted to do. And so, so that was actually really fun, and I really enjoyed that. But it was a lot of hard work.
What was it like moving from Pittsburgh to Cape Town?
Yeah, it was really hard. So I got married maybe 6 months before that. And
what's your wife's name again?
My wife's name is Robin, and we've been together since 2008. So we moved in 2012. Excuse me. And we were just married, and in 2011 we got married, and it was one. You know, it was a big sacrifice. You know, for her to move as well. With me, I was like, oh, I have my dream job. But, you know, she was on a spousal visa, so she couldn't work. And so that was hard.
And what does your wife do?
She's a legal secretary at a law firm. And what is interesting, I think, well, what was difficult, though, is that, so we both moved, and it was nice that we were both experienced. We had the same experience, you know, and so, you know, we could, like, you know, help each other through it. But, you know, neither of us ever lived abroad, and it was, honestly, the first 6 months of being in Cape Town, I was horrible. Like, I went there as a, like, this is gonna be the best job ever. I'm so excited. I've literally wanted to do this for, since probably 2002. I wanted to do HIV-specific research in sub-Saharan Africa, in a country that, where the effect of HIV is the worst. And so I get there with these really high expectations. And my wife was like, oh, okay, well, this will be really good for your career. And like at the time too, my wife, she was diagnosed with depression and anxiety and stuff. And so it was like, you know, it was hard because it was, you know, she was like, oh, well, our, you know, so like that was just like an extra.
Before you went?
Before we went, you know, and so she's something that she still deals with. And so then that was something that was hard because it was like, okay, well, we both need to find like clinicians as soon as we get there. You know, I need my medication. So I was on Concerta or Ritalin at the time, or Adderall maybe. So that like helps me focus. And my wife, you know, she needed her like antidepressants or like SSRIs. And so then we needed to we had like a lot of things we needed to do immediately. And so we were able to do that and stuff. But the thing that I noticed though is that as soon as I got to work, everything was really, really slow. And it was much slower than it was as a graduate student. And that's something that's typical as postdocs. When you first start, you're getting your bearings and stuff. But also, the extra hurdle, though, was that I was also getting my bearings living in Cape Town. And, like, Cape Town is a great city, but everything was a little different. And once that honeymoon period was over, maybe in, like, a few weeks or, like, a month, it was like, oh, we can't just keep doing all the touristy fun things. And this is, we are living here. And that was really hard. And so then I started to like really be bumming out. Like I was really bummed and like, I really was hating it, honestly. And I went through times where I felt like, oh, well, I'm not going to be able to do the research that I wanted to because I thought that I could go there and get all these granulomas immediately. But no one was doing that work at that time, so I didn't realize how hard it was. And the people I was contacting for it, like everything was kind of falling through. And it was also hard because my wife had to like adjust to like, you know, she was at home and she was like trying to meet people and stuff. And so as I'm like feeling worse and worse, my wife starts getting, she has like got, her friends have been really involved in like improv comedy here in the States. And so she found this group of people in Cape Town. And then like that, like really made this change that was wonderful. And she also found a wonderful counselor to talk to or therapist to talk to that helped like modify some medication as well. And so she is like starting to feel a lot better. And I'm just feeling worse and worse and I hate it. And I remember, and this is like, one of, like, I feel like the saddest memories of being in Cape Town, or just, like, the idea of Cape Town was, we lived downtown in Cape Town. And we had this nice apartment, or flat, and there's this window to one of the mountains there. And it was just a beautiful view. It was just really beautiful. And I remembered waking up for, it must have been months, and looking at those mountains and literally, I don't want to curse, but literally just being like, these mountains, and just hating them, and just being like, I can't believe how much I hate this view. And it was just like, just really indicative of just like how I was feeling. And at work, I would, you know, go to work and just kind of sit there, and then I would try to kill some time. I didn't want to do experiments I was doing before because I wanted to get through, do these granulomas, and they were really hard to get, and I didn't realize how hard it was. I had a really hard time. I mean, I'm very talkative and stuff, but I think for that first 6 months, I was just kind of sit in my corner and chat with people a little bit. And then there were times where I was like, I'm going to go for a walk and just leave my stuff at my desk and just kind of go and like sit and just wait for like an hour. And then be like, oh, so then people think I'm maybe doing something, and then I go back. Like it was horrible, and so anyway, so it was cool that like my wife's feeling better, I'm feeling bad, and it's nice when you have, you know, someone supportive and you guys can help each other. But I remember, so that was, we moved in May, yeah, I think May, at the end of May in 2012, and then we were planning a trip back to visit our families in my family in St. Louis and Robin's family in Pennsylvania. And we flew back and we met we saw Robin's family and we like hung out there for like a few days, and it was super awesome. Her family is really, really great. And that was awesome. And then we flew to St. Louis, and I remember so we were gone for 6 months, maybe. I don't know, however that math works. We flew back for Thanksgiving. So what is it? June, July, August, September, October, November. Yeah, 6 months. And I saw my family at the airport, and I start to cry. And it was one of those things where I was like, just so happy to see them, and I was just so unhappy there. That it was really, it was just a huge surprise to them. I mean, like, we talked a little bit about it. And then I think it just, I didn't realize like how much like it affected me just being so far away and also being there. So it was just, it was a really difficult time. And then I have to say, I think like the next like 6 months to a year, things were definitely getting better and I was making more progress at work. So I was feeling a lot better. But there were also times where, like, I would like FaceTime with friends and family, and just being, just thinking, like, I don't know what I'm doing here. And there were times where I questioned myself, and I was doing it regularly. And there were times too where I like fought really hard, and I feel like fought is the correct word, to get the tissue samples that I needed to work with, those granulomas. And I had to push so hard and push in such a confident way that, like, oh, I'm going to get this, I'm going to do these experiments, and then they're going to be done immediately and all this. And I was like, everything's going to be lined up and it's going to be perfect, you know, in order to get other people on board. And as I was pushing that really hard, like, my sole focus was to get those tissue samples. But then I remembered my boss, like, sat me down and was like, all right, we figured out where to get these. This is awesome. And my boss was really helpful with that. And I get them, and everything's all set up. And I remember that next morning, like, waking up and, like, having, I don't know if I would call it a panic attack, but waking up and just being like, what am I doing? Like, I haven't thought about this. Like, I knew basically what I was going to do, but I thought that I fought so long for this one thing, and I finally got, I'm the dog, I caught the car, and the car were these samples, and then I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this? And, like, I was like, I wasn't, all the experiments that I said I was going to do, I knew I could do, but there was definitely a lot of time that were, like, you have to work things out. And so I was just really scared, and that was something where, you know, I remember my wife, Robin was saying, it was that morning, and, like, I'm literally looking in the mirror and just being like, what am I doing? And, you know, and she's like, you know, you can do this. Like, this is what you said you wanted to do, and, like, you finally got it, and, you know, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard. You know, and then there was, like, a slow progression, and then I really... after getting those samples and starting to work on this project, and my wife was feeling really good. She was involved with, she had a bunch of friends there. She's very social, and I'm social at work, but I really like watching Netflix, and you know, that's what I mostly prefer to do. And so it was really, yeah, so it was really awesome. And, like, I have to say, the last, I think, year and a half that we were there, it was really wonderful. But there was the horrible 6 months. And then, another 6 months. And then we got to the point, and this was actually really nice, I think, conclusion to our time in Cape Town. But we got to the point where, like, my experiments were becoming more and more involved, and there were these new projects coming up. And my wife, Robin, and I, like, were talking about this, and I was like, if we don't leave soon, you know, I will be here for at least 2 more years, you know, and it was one of those, been here 3 years, it'll either be 3 years or 5 or 6 years. And my current boss, she got an R01 grant, which is a very good grant to get from the NIH. And she was starting a project that was looking at the co-infection, and it was also back in the monkey model that I was working with, or similar monkey model that I was working with in graduate school. And so then I was able, I talked to her about coming back and doing that, or coming back and moving back to Pittsburgh and doing that science again. So, yeah, so it was cool. It was a really great experience, but it definitely had a lot of, there were a lot of times that were horrible, and a lot of times they were really hard and stuff. So, yeah.
And so you never at any point were like, well, maybe we will just like live here for a while. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like make Cape Town like a longer term home.
Like initially I thought, I was like, oh, well, we could be here for a really long time. We could live here permanently. But that quickly changed. And then after things were really good, you know, I was talking about possibly like having collaborations with University of Cape Town and the University of Pittsburgh and trying to figure out a way to, you know, work at both universities. And it's just really complex and difficult, I think, to get something like that done. But it definitely was hard. Or I don't think that after, I don't think for the majority of the time that we were there, we ever wanted to make it a permanent home, or even longer than 3 years. Because 3 years was a really long time, and it's, you know, one of the best experiences of my life. And I think that one of the reasons why it was one of the best is because there was this really hard time at the beginning. And then, you know, my wife and I, we've been together for a really long time. Or it's been 2008. Yeah, so I guess almost 10 years. But at that time, you know, we were married. We had our first to third anniversary, or first anniversary there, or wedding anniversary. And one thing that was really nice, though, is that, like, I feel like it made us closer, because it was either, like, it's either going to be horrible for us or it's going to be great. Mm-hmm. And, like, at the beginning, it was really hard, you know? And, like, when I'm unhappy or she's unhappy, you know, we had to, like, figure that out. But I'm incredibly thankful that we went there. But I'm really glad it was 3 years, and I was like, I have no interest in living abroad anymore.
Got it. So you came back to the University of Pittsburgh in what year?
It's 2015.
Okay. And is that's a time-limited project, 3 years? Or is it kind of open-ended?
Oh, for my current project?
Yeah.
So this was... I'm currently funded on an R01 that's 5 years long. Mm-hmm. And I think there's two more years on it, but there's a new project that my boss just received funding for that is another 5 years. And so I could be here much, much longer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's time. Yeah, everything I think in science is time limited. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's, everything's time limited. If you have funding, then that's great. But I mean, it's hard, because it's like, what am I going to do in 5 years when that grant is up? And if I can get funding or my boss can get funding, that'll be wonderful. But if not, then, you know, I'm out of luck. So that's something that's really difficult as a scientist.
Mm-hmm. And what do you sort of, like, what's your sort of vision of the future in terms of like what you would like to see yourself doing in 10 years?
Yeah. Well, so like my fantasy job, all right, so literally my fantasy job would be to become an advocate for people with learning disabilities full time. And so that would actually be moving out of sciences. But not totally moving out of sciences, with a specific goal of increasing the disability diversity within sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And like if that means that I would be work on policy, and by policy I mean like NIH policy or state policy, or even working with universities and stuff, increasing knowledge about people with specifically learning disabilities, because I know a lot more about it and can personally attest to it, and getting more students involved in STEM fields, like that is something that I would love to do. The hard part about that is there's not much money in that, so you can have all these good intentions, but if I can't feed myself, so what I think, what's probably the most likely is I'll continue doing the disability work that I'm currently doing, and writing about it and wanting to, like, you know, get published, and hopefully I can get this book out. And continue giving talks and working with the University of Pittsburgh and other universities. So I've been meeting with a lot of people. So doing that and also doing being a scientist. Because I have really two passions. And my first passion is this disability advocacy stuff. And my second passion really is science. I love science. I love the pursuit of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I really love the HIV tuberculosis research. Because you have these two very diverse pathogens. You have a virus and a bacteria, and the bacteria doesn't change very much, and the virus changes all the time, and the virus is relatively new. It's a new pathogen to infect people, and the bacteria has been around since, they're found mummies with the bacteria in it. And so you have these diverse things that have just worked together really well to just have two cause a horrible, horrible outcome, which is just killed so many people. Mm-hmm. And HIV actually is the reason why there was a reemergence of tuberculosis. And so without HIV, tuberculosis might be eradicated or close to it, I think. I love the science of this and also this advocacy stuff. And so right now I'm just trying to be open to I'm trying to stay open in both of these areas.
Are there other groups that are doing advocacy work like you would like to do, or do you want to start your own organization in a perfect world?
Yeah. So both. And so for so the short answer is both. And there is this really cool organization I'm currently working with. The International Dyslexia Association. It's an international organization, but they have a PA branch and an office here in Pittsburgh. I was connected to some of those people, and I'm currently working with them and been taking a lot of meetings and trying to spread the word about disabilities. They focus on dyslexia. My learning disability is a reading disability, and so some people call it dyslexia, some people don't. I kind of use a more broad term just because, I in my diagnosis it never literally said dyslexia, but it's psychiatrist preference, I think, on what they diagnose. And so that's something that I really want to do. But if I rewind a little bit, the little longer answer is, when I was at the University of Cape Town, I wrote an article about being a foreigner being an American working in South Africa on tuberculosis. And I wrote this article, and it was published in a blog that this real well-known journal maintains. And it was on the tuberculosis day. So this must have been in 2014 or 13. I can't really remember.
What's the blog name?
It's so it's Public Library of Sciences, and it was their Speaking of Medicine blog.
Okay.
They have a bunch of journals that are pretty popular. And so I write this article, and I got some pretty good feedback, and I also got some negative feedback because I talked about some of the complications of working at University of Cape Town and how it's harder to do research there than it is to do it here. And so after I wrote that article, I decided, I was like, well, I want to write an article about being a scientist with learning disabilities. And I contacted an editor through an editor that I was currently working with. And I wrote that article, and that was definitely in 2014. And that was really well received. And it literally, I think the title of it was I'm a scientist with learning disabilities, and that's okay. I think that's the title of it. And what I noticed, though, was that I ended up getting hundreds of emails from people that were in similar experiences, or just the system didn't work, and by system, education system, or they were undiagnosed and they had these issues, or they also had PhDs and they also had learning disabilities, and a lot of engineers and scientists. And so I was really taken back by that. And honestly, I think that article was the article that whoever from your organization actually contacted me because I wrote that, I think.
Mm.
And so after I wrote that, I started kind of collating all of the people that are all of like the messages and trying to like figure out like the biggest issues people had. And then I started interviewing a handful of them. I wanted to interview a lot more, but it's just too time consuming. And so then that kind of planted the seed that, oh, well, this is actually a good, like actually people might want to hear my personal story, and then I might be able to use that as a mechanism for, to help like institute change in the, like changing like the stigma. Oh, if you have learning disabilities, you're stupid. Like, I don't think that's true. And also helping increase our ability to increase the disability diversity within scientific fields. And so then when I moved back to Pittsburgh, I was like, okay, well, I definitely want to pursue this. And so then through a bunch of different meetings and like emailing different schools and contacting people, I eventually got into contact with this International Dyslexia Association. But like before that, I must have sent out 3 or 4 or 5 dozen emails to different organizations, different people. And it was one essentially failure after another. And I was like, look, I have this personal story that I think could be helpful to people. I just want to be able to talk to people and try to help like inspire them to like people with learning disabilities and also eventually like help modify policy. But like I need to walk before I can run. And it wasn't until a few people at this organization actually contacted me, and I contacted them, and then they responded, and we've been talking a lot over the last like few months. And you know, I want to get more involved in their organization, and I want to like learn more about the process and like how to get things done, because I think one thing that's really important is that is changing things within the system itself. Like I don't think saying like, oh, the education system is terrible, and it's horrible for people with learning disabilities, and like it can be. But I also think that like the more knowledge people have about learning disabilities, the easier it's going to be for people to excel.
I have really two last questions for you. One has to do with sort of this theme I think that has emerged as you've like talked about your story, which is that, which has come up in a lot of the interviews that we've been doing, which is the sort of struggle between, you know, what is sort of expected, or not expected maybe, but what is sort of put upon the individual themselves to sort of adapt themselves to the environment that they're in versus sort of changing the environment to better sort of suit a wider, you know, diversity of bodies or learning styles or whatever. So, I mean, it sounds like most of what has allowed you to be successful has been sort of upon your own, like, adapting yourself and sort of changing how you approach, you know, learning problems or obstacles.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah, yeah. So the only way that it really works, I think, is finding, I can only do so much, like myself. There are some things that I will always be bad at. And like reading, like even like reading emails, you know, like I essentially skim them, and it's really hard for me to like comprehend all the things that are in them, especially because emails are essentially out of context. They're just short messages, and they're really easy for me to mess up. I have a really hard time like maintaining my schedule, where I have to have everything like written in, like put in my phone. And there's a technician that I work with that actually is really, really good at all of that organization stuff, and it's really nice, and we're friends, and she is like, I will be like, Tara, what are we supposed to do? What are we doing this week or that? And then I get like the rundown and stuff. And is it possible for me to do what I'm doing without Terra or without a Terra. But it's also, it takes a lot more like mental energy, and it can be really exhausting. Tara was actually out for maternity leave for maybe a few months. And so that was one thing where I was like, okay, so now I have to make sure everything is in the calendar. I have to make sure everything is correct. And that was definitely something that definitely took me back. And I was like, okay, I need to deal with this. And so that's a part of me, like, I guess, adapting, like, how I do things, but also saying, like, look, I need help with this. Mm-hmm. And I think also with my current boss, she is, she's also really great. But, you know, like, in our meetings, you know, she'll send me, like, all right, this is the action plan. These are the things that I expect us to get done. And I think that's something that just was really helpful to me. So that is her adapting to me. Even as a graduate student, my committee, when I took that test, they adapted me, saying, like, look, I'm going to need to take a second or two. And a second or two isn't a long time, and that's a very reasonable accommodation. But it can feel a lot. It can feel like a lot of time when you're just standing there and you're nervous. And so then that's them adapting to me as a... when I talk to my bosses, like my PIs, my graduate school PI, or even, you know, my current one, there were times where, you know, like I might need a little more time than the average, whatever that means, the average graduate student, to like explain my research or to describe something new. Or I might need to be like, okay, I need to go back and re-explain this. And, you know, it just, I mean, that takes patience on my current boss and even my graduate school boss, you know, when I first learned those techniques. So it's definitely a constant balance. Like, well, you don't need, like, I don't expect everybody, like, I don't want to be coddled, but there are certain things that I'm just really bad at. And even things with, like, I'm looking in a box that has, like, 96 slots in it, and each of the slots has a different vial in it, and they're all written something, and I will like be like, so-and-so, can you find this thing? And it's one of those things where it's like, if I look at this, it will literally take me 10 minutes to find it. Someone else can find it in a minute, you know, and they can like quickly scan. And so in that light, I talk about my learning disabilities a lot. And I mean, the way I deal with hard things is I joke about them, but I've learned to like actively talk about learning disabilities because I think it's important to like increase awareness about them. And if people are fortunate like I am, you know, there are a lot of people that like will help out in those situations. But I think it's also important to not like rely on them, like to make them like a crutch, like something that you actually need.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the things that you just mentioned are sort of these kind of like moments of, maybe for lack of a better term, like moments of crisis where, you know, you're not able to do enough on your own. And so you sort of require that there's, yeah, like someone else there who's in a like position of power or something that can sort of also be flexible. But that's still sort of limiting, like in terms of like structural change, that's not really a massive sort of shift, right? That's sort, yeah, of saying like it depends on individual people and like their attitudes, which, yeah, which is something, but it's not a sort of, you know, vision of restructuring like the way like a graduate school training,
yeah, yeah,
might work. So I just wonder if there are things that like you've thought about as you're like moving more and more into this advocacy realm about how you could just sort of, I mean, I guess along the lines of like thinking like universal design, but with like learning disabilities, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
like how could you imagine maybe like one thing that you could change sort of at the structural level about like the graduate school experience that would just make it more friendly to everyone, and then wouldn't have to be these, like, you know, individual, it wouldn't sort of fall on the shoulders of individual mentors or students.
I think, and this is probably a bad answer, or too abstract of an answer, but I think the biggest thing is just increasing awareness of learning disabilities and getting rid of that stigma. That can't just happen at the graduate school level, because you have so many people that either are failing out or are refusing to continue on, or are giving up or changing majors or deciding to not go to college because they feel stupid, because they can't read well. And so that is something that I think, at least, I don't know, structurally, that needs to change overall, just like in societal terms. In graduate school, what I think would help out a lot is there are some scholarships to increase diversity within increase underrepresented individuals, and that includes people with disabilities, but it also includes like people of color, people. Pacific Islanders, and so there's also a different. There are some diversity scholarships. I think that a lot of people with learning disabilities don't realize that they are allowed to apply to those things, and so I think that, like, at least just increasing awareness about that. I actually contacted NIH about there. There's a sentence in. In every R01, every grant that NIH writes, and it essentially says something like, "Oh, people from underrepresented in sciences, and that includes, you know, people of like certain races and people with disabilities and people from socioeconomic disadvantaged backgrounds are always encouraged to apply." And I was like, "Oh, this is great! Like, you know, there should be, because like things like haven't." You know, like, even in science, like, things aren't leveled off. You know, there's still incredible disparities. But I contacted, and it took a long time for me to actually get, like, a straight answer. But essentially, NIH uses those grants as a, or uses that sentence just for demographic information. So they don't, so I think that there could be more grants. There are some grants that are specific to people that are underrepresented, but I think that there could be a better push for increasing that. Yeah. And that's something that I actually really would like to get involved in. That diversity scholar or fellowship that I'm talking about from NIH, that's only for graduate students. It's not for postdocs. And so a part of me is like, well, that should also be for postdocs. Like, things don't magically get leveled off once you get a PhD. And I think that's the mentality NIH has. It's like, oh, well, now the playing field's level. And, you know, the playing field is not level. That's some things that I think would be helpful. In addition to that, I think undergraduate schools that are specific for people with learning disabilities would also help out, just because then it would be like a better environment for those students to excel, and then they'd be more comfortable applying for graduate school. But like at the graduate school level, I think it's going to be really, really difficult beyond being able to, like, put more money in this area and, like, reducing the stigma, I think, is really important.
One last question that's sort of specific to some of the themes that have emerged from some of the other interviews that we've done, which has to do with, like, the kinds of technologies or, like, tools that you've, you know, discovered or developed on your own over time to adapt to, you know, the sort of abilities that you have in the environment that you're in, right? So yeah. I'm thinking of things that you've mentioned throughout the interview already, like recording lectures when you were a student, and the sort of interesting, you mentioned the Kurzweil 3000
software.
Which turns things into PDFs, turns...
It's a text-to-speech software.
Text-to-speech
That's great,
software.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And then I'm also thinking about, like, the human support as, like, a kind of like a social technology,
yeah, yeah.
right? That, like, you've had, you know, key sort of tutors and, like, you know, people who have been your PIs or your supervisors or whatever who have been,
yeah.
like, particularly helpful. Is there anything else that you want to...
Well, so I think that the technology that helped me, just first technology, the technology that helped me through all my schooling was pretty low tech, because I didn't, like, text-to-speech software wasn't good 10 years ago, or at least the ones that I tried, or they were terrible. And so it was literally highlighting, typing things up, flashcards, and recording, and just listening to those recordings a lot, and just, like, putting in the time. And so that was really necessary. You know, it wasn't until recently when I started taking classes again for the Certificate in Disability Law Studies here at the Pitt Law School, I discovered the Kurzweil text-to-speech software. And there's a lot of software, text-to-speech software, that is really good. And it is amazing. It highlights the individual words. It can highlight the sentences while it's reading. You can, like, put notes in the books that you're reading from. All you have to do, essentially, when you're at a university or a university that is a part of some program, and I don't even know what it's called, accessibility program. You buy a hard copy of the book, or you buy a Kindle version of the book, and then they contact the publisher, and then the publisher essentially gives you a PDF of it, and then the PDF is easily readable from the text-to-speech software. And so then that's really awesome. And that was really helpful when I started taking these law school classes, because just law is written horribly. I mean, it's all jargon. And so it was really nice being able to pause and rewind. And by rewind, it's like click back two sentences or go forward two sentences. And so technology-wise, I think is wonderful. There's so much more technology available. With something as simple as speech-to-text software. I mean, you can do that in Google. You can do that just on your computer, just depending on how good your microphone or the microphone is. There's also a software that is, like, embedded in pens, and I think there's, like, Echo Pen is called. I've never used it, but it seems like really cool technology where there's a record of how you're writing, a record of your notes, and that's something that you could use, or even if your professor is like accessibility friendly, then they could do it, and then there's a record of everything that they did and when they did it, and it records everything, like audio and how they're writing. And it's fairly accurate, so it's pretty neat technology. So there's a tremendous amount of technology that's helpful. And technology is only as good as people using it, and so you can have all the technology in the world, but you need to be able to use it, you need to be trained on it, and you need to be able to use it appropriately. But I think the most important thing is, at least for me, and I'm assuming that for most other people, are the people in your life that help you overcome, or again, I don't really like overcome, to help you deal with your disabilities and work with them to achieve whatever goal it is that you have. And so I was incredibly fortunate, and I'm still fortunate, where, you know, my first advocates were my parents, and my brother and sister are very, very supportive. I always had, like, supportive friends and could talk about disability stuff or whatever, and we, like, joke about it, but it was never a big deal. And, like, I think I said this the last time, the way that I want people to approach people with learning disabilities is like, oh, you have a learning disability? Oh, that's fine. That's it. That's fine. Okay. Like, fine. Your eyes are hazel or blue or whatever gray my eyes color is. So that was wonderful. Going to Bradley University, having a disability resource office where they, like, essentially force the students to talk to their to their teachers or their professors about their learning disability. That's important, because then you learn to self-advocate for yourself, look out for yourself. And, you know, that they were wonderful. Coming to Pitt when I was a graduate student, I was afraid to admit that I had learning disabilities. I wanted to, like, go back and hide that. And it wasn't until a single conversation I had with Joanne, who ended up being my PI, and I got my PhD from her lab, but the conversation I had was just about research, and that conversation went really well, and she was so friendly. I have learning disabilities. Are there accommodations I could get? And she sent me to the disability office, which was really great. And even my coworkers have been supportive. They joke that I use learning disabilities as an excuse, and I usually use it for everything if I drop something. But I mean, that's just because of joking about it. But I also, like, the ulterior motive of that is that, like, I think it's important for people to talk about, you know, to be open about it. And I also I see a therapist too, and it's like sometimes, like, you can have great friends and you can have wonderful, like, even like with my wife, is she's an awesome, she's, you know, my biggest support, my support network now. Like, sometimes there's, like, you need someone that's, like, outside of your, like, world that can, like, help you out. And, you know, the therapist I see, I think I've been seeing her for about a year, has been great. And, like, you know, something that, like, I never really dealt with depression or anxiety. And my wife actually has bipolar too. And so that's going to be something that's, like, really difficult, especially before we learned, you know, that she had that. It was really hard to, like, deal with, try to figure out, like, what is going on? Why would you act like that? Like, you know, things just didn't click. And so then it literally was like, you know, I was just like, oh, I feel like I need to, you know, sometimes, like, get help with, like, trying to figure out what's the best way? How is the best way that what can I do to be helpful? And, like, how can I learn to, like, say, like, oh, well, this thing happened and I understand that, you know, or this thing happened and that was, you know, sad or hard. And, like, this is something that, like, a therapist is much better at talking with than, like, a friend who's just, like, I don't know, or a parent and stuff. And so I feel like I've been so fortunate that I've, like, built this, like, network of people that are just, like, really, really, really helpful. And I really just try not to hang out with people that I don't like, or, you know, there's a lot of people with friends that they don't like, and I'm like, why are you friends? Like, you shouldn't be your friends. Like, get another friend. And so there's just, yeah, so I feel like there's this whole network and stuff that I was able to build over the years. And so that's why I think, even when you mentioned what are the systemic change or the systematic changes that can happen, it is those PIs in a graduate school. They're the ones that are like this, like, first line of defense. If, oh, someone is not reading well or doing something, what's going on? Like, asking them about it, you know? And if a student has learning disabilities and they are diagnosed, being comfortable with that. Like, okay, that's fine. Oh, so you might not be good at a certain thing. That's okay. Let's try to figure out a way to work with that, or try to get you better at it, or something else. And even with, like, other graduate students. Like, I was the kid in graduate school. I sat in the front row. I had my digital recorder. It was digital, which I thought was super cool. It was before iPhones, I think. And I, like, some of my friends that eventually who I became friends with at graduate school, because my first semester of graduate school was really rough because I just felt, like, out of place. And but they would joke with me. They'd be like, Colin, we totally just were like, who is this overachiever in front? And I would be like, dude, I'm just trying to catch up to you guys. And so we, like, joke about it now. But that's something that it's like, you know, being comfortable with it. And, like, okay, someone's recording their lecture. Like, that's okay. Yeah, so I think that the people are the most important thing. And then use technology when you can. Or, you know, that is actually helpful. So,
great. Do you have any follow-up? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you so much.